elder to currently younger. Perhaps Grace can lead the piano on the last song and we'll have Curran the youngest. Today I feel I have something in common with the people on Have I Got News For You? In that they often find themselves recording an episode before a major event happens. And their jokes have to tentatively guess at what the result of that event might be. Or maybe just decisively swing one way or the other in the hope that they've made the right guess. I wrote this sermon earlier in the week, so what I've done is I've just made some delete as appropriate segments to make sure that I'm on the right track on however you feel about the election. So now that your ideal government, or worse nightmare, has taken power, I'm sure you are ecstatic or inconsolable. I've even made a little flag to wave that carefully covers each potential outcome. Now, I don't know how closely you've followed the election, but I think whatever your view on it, there's one particular part of the passage today that is likely to stand out. Ineffective and unproductive. Perhaps there might be one particular party in your mind that those words conjure images of. Perhaps you might remember some of the election's finest moments and stunts. David Cameron's There's No Money Left letter, Ed Miliband's giant stone promises, I think that's one for the ages, Nigel Farage's pint glass balancing act. But I wonder too, how often did you feel that way about your contribution? British politics is funny in that even though we all get to vote, the government will often change based on just a few people in a few in a small number of constituencies. And we call these swing votes or swing seats. These are the few places that will decide who the government will be. The vast majority will vote for the same party that they vote for every time and the same candidates, irrespective of campaigns. Now, if you're not in a swing seat, the whole process can seem a little bit pointless. You watch the debates, you weigh the decisions, you carefully make your choice, and then you get the same party that you've had since VE Day. It's easy to become cynical and to feel ineffective and unproductive. Now, of course, in a few weeks, the election will have blown over. Baby Charlotte Cambridge Windsor will be getting the attention that her royal gurgles deserve. We'll remember the war in Syria and Jeremy Clarkson's sacking. But I wonder if that feeling still persists, feeling ineffective and unproductive. We often celebrate heroes in the church, people who go out into the world and make converts, fishers of men. If I were to ask you for some great Christians, who would I get? Billy Graham? C.S. Lewis? You always have to adapt these for your congregations, you know? Just like in the election, it seems that all the change in the Christian world comes from just a small number of people. The people who can turn everyone around them into swing votes. People who change the opinions of entire generations and countries, while your friends seem to just state the same doubts, and they stay the same as they ever have. It's easy to think that because you're not actively converting new Christians, that you are somehow not doing your job. That because you're not getting chances to share the gospel, that you are somehow a disappointment. Ineffective and unproductive. So we're continuing our series on LICC's fruitfulness on the front line. And essentially, that's the issue we're tackling today. If we are not actively making disciples, if we're not changing governments and saving souls, what are we doing? And what does God want us to do? Well, let's look at the passage. This is the second letter that Peter sends to the church in Asia, and it's focused on a problem that the church has always faced. Once you've been saved, what do you do? Now, we can assume by the tone of this letter that Peter is writing to a group of people who have decided to follow Jesus, but are not really doing anything about it. Now, in response, Peter says what we've just heard. For this very reason, make every effort to add to your faith, goodness, and to goodness, knowledge, and to knowledge, self-control. And he goes on. Just being forgiven is not all there is to a healthy Christian life. And Peter is not the only one to remind us of this problem. Paul tells us not to go on sinning. Jesus warns us that God will spit out the lukewarm. There is more to being a follower of Christ than that initial conversion. And Peter lays out what that might look like. Now, I think we can understand that better if we consider the parable that Jesus told of two men building their houses. One builds on rock and one builds on sand. Now, we know from countless sermons and Sunday school how this story goes. And we know that the rock represents God. You can probably even sing a couple of versions of the song that goes with this. But I wonder how much we've really thought about the house and what that represents. If God is the rock, then the house is our character. It's what we build for ourselves on the stability of our salvation. When the storms of this life come, our first defense is the walls that we have built on God's word. You can, of course, cling to the rock, but you get a lot less wet if you've managed to erect a roof and some windows. Faith, goodness, self-control, perseverance. Each of us will build in different ways and focus on different purposes, but it will be our character that allows us to serve God, not just our salvation. So I wonder, what would your ideal Christian house look like? If God pried open the clouds and told you to build a home that represents Christian character, what would you choose? For me, it conjures images somewhere between a Starbucks and a soup kitchen. Large, welcoming windows, welcome badges, plentiful seating, the walls lined with Why Jesus pamphlets. A place full of the downtrodden and hungry, with me outside shepherding in the willing masses to come and have their feet washed and their problems listened to. We could even be a little more enterprising and imagine our Christian house as one of the election battle buses, zipping from town to town to share the good news with willing crowds in schools, in warehouses. Maybe yours would be a hut built in some distant land to meet and greet the great unchurched. It can be easy to reduce Christian character to simply how well can you share the gospel? Or how much are you willing to give up for God? But when we do this, we forget that our purpose is far greater than evangelism. We are creating and living in God's kingdom. Now, let me give you an example of what this might look like. And seeing as this is an LICC series, I'm going to pinch one of theirs. So this is about Andrew. Now, Andrew is a manager at a successful company. He looks after a team of people directly, and he has oversight for a number of other teams. The company is seeking to improve performance across their workforce and comes up with a new initiative. In each department, every worker will be ranked. The top 15 achievers will receive an additional bonus, and the bottom 15 won't receive a bonus. In fact, they'll receive a pay cut. The problem is, there's no one in Andrew's department who deserves a pay cut. In fact, in discussion with other managers, he finds that all departments are facing the same problem. When an entire team is working well, they are being forced to arbitrarily choose some people to punish, to select good workers and tell them that they will be fined because it's company policy. Now, what does Christian character look like in that situation? Would converting the managers solve it? Converting the workers? Sorry, you're not getting paid. Let's talk about Jesus. Let's have another example. Reg moves to a new city when he retires to be closer to his family. He finds a new church and starts settling into a community, but he quickly finds that he's not meeting people outside of it. In fact, he realizes that the only people he knows are Christians. So how do you show Christian character when you're surrounded by Christians? How do you let your light shine in a room full of lights? Who do you tell the good news to when everyone already knows it? Serving God is not as simple as just telling other people about him. God's kingdom doesn't just need Christian bookshops. Jesus talks about a new heaven and a new earth, but how will that work if our only skill is evangelism? God needs offices and workshops, schools and care homes. God's kingdom is already here, and we are already working within it. Now, our Christian character can bring God's kingdom to areas where evangelists and churches can never go and make differences that they can never make. How hard would a church have to work to get access to the people that you see every day? What would they have to do to get the influence that you hold in your workplace or in the groups you go to or the people you know? Simply by being in that place, you have the opportunity to bring God's kingdom. So what does that look like? Jesus gives the two greatest commands, as love the Lord your God with all your heart and all your soul and all your strength and all your mind, and love your neighbor as yourself. And when he's asked to explain who that neighbor might be, he tells the story of the Good Samaritan. An injured man is lying next to a road, but is ignored by both a priest and a holy man, and instead it's a Samaritan that picks him up and puts him on his donkey. He takes him to safety and pays for his recovery. Now, in the story, the Samaritan doesn't hang around to give the man a tract. He doesn't seek to convert him or convince him to change. He's not waiting by the bed when the man wakes up to say, Jesus did this. He doesn't even offer him a place on a road safety management course. He sacrifices of himself in order to meet the man's needs. Now, Andrew decided that he couldn't arbitrarily choose someone in his department to be punished, and so he refused and told his managers why. He risked his job and his security, but he showed godly character, and the policy was changed. Reg felt compelled to pick up litter in his neighborhood, and every day he left the house with a litter picker and a black bag and methodically cleaned the street. He met a need in his community and found a way to serve God. And at Easter, he gave out little crosses to everyone who came to say hello. Now, I wonder what stories you could tell about godly character. I'm certain if I went around the room that we would have more than a few. Now, LICC, they use this graphic to describe your impact on the world around you. Around 7.5% of people in the UK go to church once a month. And on a Sunday, it can be easy to feel that that's us in the corner, clustered together against the encroaching mass of grey. When laws are passed on religious expression and governments seem to care less and less about Christian values, it's easy to feel ineffective and unproductive. But actually, a more accurate image might be this one. Or maybe still this one. There we go. Might be this one. 7.5% of the population, when spread through the grid, have a much larger influence. Each red dot there coming into contact with so much more of the grey and changing the whole grid. How many people do you see every day that don't know Jesus? What organizations or companies or social groups are you a part of that don't have godly values? By putting you in that place, God extends his kingdom there. Not simply so that everyone can sign up and get their salvation, but so the organization itself can work for God. God needs accountants as much as he needs evangelists. Because when was the last time an evangelist changed the way a company paid its workers? God needs teachers and doctors and nurses as much as he needs vicars, because who is more likely to change the culture of our education, of our hospitals? God needs retirees, grandparents, and carers as much as he needs missionaries, because who else is going to bring wisdom to the next generation? As we seek to be fruitful on the front line, what steps can we take to use our godly character for God? Firstly, find your front line. Now that we've rolled out the blue carpet, we're likely to see cuts in many areas that have already been sorely tested. Some of you may be worried about the years ahead. Where are the areas where your godly character is going to matter most? Now, this may well be something that you're already doing. It often is. Although the Bible focuses on those that God flings into adversity, the majority of believers through the ages have simply been people living their lives for him. Who are you in contact with every day? How can you change the culture of your workplace, of your street, of the groups you attend? One lady in the Fruitfulness on the Frontline material that I think you'll hear about thought she had no front line because she didn't work and only met people through the church. However, when she spoke to other people within that church, she revealed that she hosted her children and her grandchildren every week for Sunday dinner. And every week they would ask what she'd done at church. You are almost certainly already on your front line. So you need to recognize it and equip yourself to be fruitful. So secondly, sharpen your character. The human condition is to revert to sinfulness unless we strive to avoid it. Add goodness to your faith and knowledge to your goodness. Develop your character so that when the storms come, you can shelter others rather than just clinging to the rock. This is perhaps the most cliche application I've given in a sermon for a while. Be a better person. But actually, what Peter is reminding us is that character is built step by step. What are you working on at the moment? And are you seeking God's guidance? Which brings us to our final point. Rely on God. Your front line may be something that you've been doing for years, or it may be something that you're only just discovering. Whatever it is, godly character only comes from one place. Your character can change the world, but it must be built on and out of faith. It's easy to get tangled up in what you think you're meant to be doing. To set yourself impossible goals in the name of Christian vision. I'm going to convert my entire workplace. I'm going to bring revival to Canley Northwest. And then burn out. Listen to what God is asking and rely on him. So, find your front line. Sharpen your character. And rely on God. We don't yet know what the impact of this election is going to be. As a teacher, it means big changes for me. And I'm certain for some of you, your life is about to change and it might become more difficult. What we do know is that whoever opens the door at number 10, it's God's kingdom that we live in. And he needs men and women of godly character in every home, in every street, in every group, and in every workplace. I'll leave you with a challenge for this week. Find the place that you have influence, where your character can be the difference in somebody's life, or in an organization, or in a group, and ask God how he wants to use you. Amen. We're going to finish with a hymn. I didn't bring the piece of paper up with me. Doug, what is the hymn we're finishing with?
Jesus be the center.
Jesus be the center.